pictures are. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haque.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg read her dissent. It was both passionate and, I think, indignant. And it was a pretty extraordinary ruling today where the Chief Justice praised the Voting Rights Act and its success and then went ahead to gut the very mechanism that made it work, and even declaring that mechanism unconstitutional without citing why it was unconstitutional and what part of the Constitution it violated. I mean, I'm completely puzzled.
I think that Justice Ginsburg's best line, and the one that most neatly encapsulates this decision, is that the Supreme Court just today justified throwing away its umbrella in the middle of a rainstorm on the ground that that umbrella had kept it dry until now. Striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which is one of the key mechanisms in that 1965 statute, is effectively what the Supreme Court has done. It's opened the gates to what we should expect to see, a flood of discriminatory and disenfranchising practices being installed in jurisdictions that used to be covered by that statute.
And the Chief Justice, he even talked about the Freedom Summer of 1964 and mentioned the towns where the civil rights workers were murdered, and then went on to say, today, both of those towns are governed by African-American mayors. Problems remain in these states and others, but there is no denying that due to the Voting Rights Act, our nation has made great strides. Now, again, it's surreal in the context of what he's done, because we know from the very last election there was an enormous number of efforts at election suppression and tricks and devices to suppress the votes of those who are likely to vote Democrat, and particularly in Texas and South Carolina, etc. So now that that barrier is removed, it's logical to expect that. But what I was impressed by in her dissent from the bench, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg turned it around on Roberts by invoking Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, saying, the great man who led the march from Selma to Montgomery and their call for the passage of the Voting Rights Act foresaw progress even in Alabama, she said. The arc of the moral universe is long, he said, but it bends towards justice. If there is a steadfast commitment to see the task through to completion, that commitment, she said, has been disturbed by today's decision. So in terms of the power of rhetoric and using icons and alluding to the Civil War, there's no question that Ruth Bader Ginsburg won the argument, but the fact remains, Aziz Haque, that the law of the land has been passed in this very negative direction.
And I think one way of thinking or reflecting upon what happened today is by noticing not just the way that, as you say, the Chief Justice strives to inoculate himself from the accusation of either racial animus or racial insensitivity by recognizing the past. Not just looking at that, but looking at what he places on the other side of the scale, right? What is it that's outweighing the need to remedy racial discrimination at the polls, something that seemingly everybody recognizes as being a great harm? The thing that's on the other side of the scale for the Chief Justice is the equal sovereignty of the states. And two things about that. The first thing is that the decision is remarkable in that it describes state sovereignty in terms of the states as they existed at the time of the Constitution's founding, at the time that something called the Tenth Amendment was enacted in 1791. Tenth Amendment is thought by some to reflect a principle of state sovereignty, and essentially ignores the fact that after the Civil War, a series of amendments, including the 14th and 15th Amendment, which are the foundation of Congress's authority to enact the Voting Rights Act, a series of amendments were passed called the Reconstruction Amendments, precisely to curtail state sovereignty. So this is a ruling that, on its face, seeks to unwind the balance of power between the federal government and the states to the state of the world pre-Civil War, pre those contractions of state sovereignty, which were seen to be necessary in order to protect racial equality, in order to vindicate, to achieve racial equality, which is it's quite the extraordinary ruling, which ties itself to the mast of 1789 and 1791 as a way of repudiating the legacy of the Civil War and the Reconstruction Amendment. So that's I think one way of thinking about it. The other thing to ponder is that the Chief Justice places a great deal of weight on what he calls the principle of equal sovereignty. All states have to be treated equally, and the Voting Rights Act, by singling out certain jurisdictions for more onerous scrutiny by the federal government, was infringing upon this principle of equal sovereignty. Well, where does this principle of equal sovereignty come from? How is the Senate, which formally treats states equally, but weighs the population of California very differently from the population of Wyoming? How is that equality for the people who live in those states? By contrast, how is the House of Representatives, if you think that all states have to be equal? Well, how do you reconcile that with the fact that all states have different voting strengths in the House of Representatives? How do you reconcile the Chief Justice's principle of equal sovereignty of the states with any or all of the federal spending programs, from education to Medicaid to defense spending to roads, which treat states unequally by giving them unequal sums of money, unequal amounts of subsidy? Taken seriously, the principle on which today's opinion rests would require the invalidation of most forms of conditional federal spending to the states. And surely that's not going to happen. And I think that that's an indication that the scrim of language about state sovereignty, this sort of notional appeal back to 1791, ought not to be taken too seriously. Nor, I think, can the appeals to the tragic deaths of 1965, to the costs and burdens that were undertaken by the members of the civil rights movement, I think can we take those invocations as anything more on the part of the Chief Justice as an effort to head off at the pass what I think is fair accusations of at minimum insensitivity to the continued existence of racial bias at the polls.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, and he's a former clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court, and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. But the part that I find extraordinary, though, is that they said that the Section 4 was unconstitutional without citing what part of the Constitution it violated. And the truth of the matter is it was just renewed very recently, signed into law for another 25 years by President George W. Bush, with 98 out of 100 senators voting for it and an equal majority in the House. Now, if that's not the 15th Amendment at work, I don't know what is.
Well, the reason that the majority gave for invalidating the statute is that the provision at issue, Section 4, contains what's called a coverage formula. And the coverage formula determines which states are subject to what's called the preclearance requirement. And the preclearance requirement is in another part of the statute.
That's five, yeah, yeah.
And what the court said is, look, when in 2005 Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, it didn't go back and recompile a body of evidence that required that demonstrated which states there was discrimination in. And so it was relying upon a record that was created in 1965, and that's irrational. Right. Implicitly, what the court is saying there, although it does not come out and say it, is that what Congress did was outside its authority under what are called the enforcement provisions of the 14th and 15th Amendments. These are provisions in the Reconstruction Amendments that vest Congress, and it was very deliberate on the part of the Reconstruction Congress, the drafters of those amendments, to say that it is Congress's role, not the courts, to determine what the appropriate remedy for structural racial injustice is. So this was the time that courts were very conservative, were not at all trusted. In the last decade and a half, the court has developed a jurisprudence that puts the courts rather than Congress in the pilot seat, even with respect to the 14th and 15th Amendments. As I said, the Chief Justice, though, does not mention any of that. It's almost like he goes out of his way to elide the existence of Congress's authority under those amendments. He just doesn't, even though that's what's at issue, he doesn't mention the amendments. He doesn't mention them at length. He doesn't analyze at length the reasons why they were enacted, allocation of authority to Congress rather than the courts. And he just says, look, this is irrational to rely upon this 1965 history in order when you reenact the statute in 2005. I think Justice Ginsburg's dissent gives very persuasive responses to that argument.
So when you said, Aziz Huq, that there was a period in our history when there was no respect for the law and that that's why the 15th and 14th Amendment gave the powers to the Congress, why should we respect these conservative justices anymore? I mean, the evidence has been pretty clear with Citizens United that that was a radical decision that's had enormous partisan advantage to Republicans and to the rich. Their recent rulings, for example, on the American Express case is completely pro-corporatist, as though they are the representatives of the 1%. And now they've come up with this ruling that they don't even bother to justify in logic and in law. What are we supposed to take from this? I mean, it's clearly open season now on voter suppression, particularly in these 15 states that are no longer covered by Section 5.
Well, I think there's two things to be said about that. The first thing is, I think that the practical effect of this ruling depends upon whether both either the Justice Department or private individuals are able to step up both activism and legal actions under, for example, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but also under other statutes, such as the National Voter Registration Act, which was at issue in another case that the Supreme Court decided this week, to compensate for the invalidation of Section 5. So I don't think that that compensation will be full bore. I think it will be partial. But I do think that it's not as if there will be nothing that flows into the absence of Section 5. The other, a second point there to note is that during the 1980s and early 90s, a Republican Justice Department used Section 5 as a way of pushing particularly African-American voters, concentrating them in single districts where they would be, you know, super majorities of electorate rather than dispersing them among several districts. And this had the effect within a state of, on the one hand, guaranteeing, what, say, one African-American representative in a congressional delegation, but on the other hand, guaranteeing seven Republican state seats. So there was under some iterations of Voting Rights Act jurisprudence, the statute has had quite ambivalent effects, and so there is a little bit of an upside there with respect to fairness in elections. I don't want to make too much of that, but that is I think part of the historical background to bear in mind. So, you know, I think that this is very, it's what's happened is absolutely serious, and organizations like the Brennan Center, where I used to work, have compiled persuasive empirical evidence of what sort of...
Right. People should go to their website, by the way, and look at that, because it's all catalogued and documented there. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Aziz Huckbert, I thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Huckbert, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The other big